So there's a cause for celebration this year in Oxford because it marks the completion of a 100-year-long project. In 1913, a group of researchers began the work towards a new dictionary of medieval Latin, and the final product is now being published in 2013. I have with me here Mark Thacker, who has been one of the dictionary's assistant editors, and he's here to talk to us about it. Hi, Mark. Thanks very much for coming in.
That's
right. So I guess the first thing to ask is, what do we mean by medieval Latin from British sources? What is in this dictionary?
That's actually a very good question. The three key words there, medieval, Latin and Britain, British, are all controversial in one way or another. Latin, you perhaps might not think so, but I'll come to that. Medieval, we've taken as our period a very wide range, one that's probably wider than most people would count as medieval. We start in around 540 AD. It's not a date chosen for any significance, it's just that that's the earliest work we have. And we go all the way up to 1600.
Wow, so over 1,000 years, over a millennia.
Yeah, very few people would call the Elizabethan period medieval, but we do. And part of the reason for that is that language in written sources lags behind speech quite a bit. So you might think that the Middle Ages ended with something like the dissolution of the monasteries in 1540 or thereabouts, and words that were around then might not have made it into print, as it were.
Of course, because it always takes a while for things like in the modern day, like tweets or whatever, to become
exactly
part
yes.
of the language officially.
So we figure that if we go up to 1600, then we should catch all the stuff that is medieval, even though we'll also catch some stuff that isn't, in any sense. We take British to mean in Britain excluding Ireland, so it's Britain properly so-called, and we accept anything from, we use as our sources, anything from British authors. We count as a British author somebody who was born in Britain, whether or not they worked in Britain. So Britons abroad do count if they've been working in a papal court in Italy, or if they've been working in Germany or somewhere like that. We also count as British letters written to Britons in some cases, where the thought is that if somebody is involved in correspondence, then they ought to be able to understand the words in that correspondence. So even if it's written by somebody who's not British, that would count as a source for us. And Latin, I said, was controversial, and the reason for that is that it's not always obvious what is a Latin word and what is a vernacular word. We take as our criterion for this whether or not a word has a Latin ending.
Okay.
But it's not always obvious when a word does have a Latin ending, because sometimes endings in Latin words look the same as endings in English words, and sometimes, very often actually in medieval manuscripts, words are written abbreviated in abbreviated form. So you can't tell whether something was an abbreviation of a word that would have looked more Latin, or whether it was just an English word that that didn't need an ending, because English doesn't have as many endings as Latin.
Sure. So there must have been, the period we're looking at basically is in Britain after the Romans sort of up and left in the 5th century then and onwards. And there must have been so many influences on the language that they were left speaking then, that's what we're talking about with the not being sure what you can class as Latin.
Yes, that's right. A standard way of importing a word into medieval Latin was just to stick Latin endings on the end of it. So you have an English word like riddle, meaning a sieve, and they would, in documents that needed to record, you know, this year we bought 5 riddles, they would write out riddle and add a Latin ending. But then, as I say, there are these cases where they don't add the ending, and they might give a little mark that shows there's something more to come, but it's been abbreviated.
Sure.
And then you don't know whether that expansion would have looked English or looked Latin.
Yes.
So we tend to err on the side of inclusion. We think it's important that people should be able to come to the dictionary and find out what a word means, even if, technically speaking, it was actually not a Latin word. These things are blurred boundaries.
So can you tell me a bit about the project itself? It's been very long in duration, started in 1913. So why now? Why do we need a new medieval Latin lexicon?
Well, this was something that was felt as a pretty pressing need in 1913 when it was suggested. The standard dictionary of medieval Latin actually was produced in the late 17th century.
Okay.
So there was a feeling that it was perhaps getting a little out of date. Partly this was because many more sources have been found since then. the 17th century dictionary had largely been the work of one man, and while it's very impressive for a work of that kind, it was limited in ways that that could be improved on. It also had the strange feature that its definitions were written in Latin, which is of limited use. Certainly these days it's of almost no use whatsoever, and even in 1913 it was less than ideal.
So you're coming to the dictionary to translate a Latin passage not knowing what the Latin says, and then all the definitions are in Latin?
That's right, yes. It was written for an older world when people just spoke Latin, as it were, at least literate, learned people did. So what happened was that an Oxford academic called Whitwell said, he got a group of scholars together to say, we want this to happen, but it's going to have to be a big project, so we need to get multiple countries involved. Given the vast number of documents in medieval Latin across Europe. So a proposal was made at an international congress of historical studies, and people seemed to be quite enthusiastic about the idea. It was a recognised need. And so there was this amazing spirit of potential international cooperation, which unfortunately fell foul of the First World War.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, of course, one doesn't want to belittle the significance of the war, but one of the minor casualties of this event was this project, this international project. So it was only in 1920 that anything started happening about it at all. And of course, by then there were some deep-rooted disagreements between people that weren't exactly rational. So it was quite difficult to get the different countries to agree on what this project would actually look like. And that really is why we've ended up with a British dictionary. There's also a German dictionary, and there's a Finnish dictionary, Polish, Dutch. The thought was that since there was a lot of source material, and since the different countries had very different ideas about what these dictionaries should focus on, it was best if they all did their own thing. Which has a certain sense to it, because the influences that come into the Latin are different in different countries.
Sure.
Obviously, in Britain, we have French and English being the primary source of imported words. In Poland, they have a very different set of local farming terms and that sort of thing. So really, a full comprehensive dictionary would have been a very unwieldy creature.
Absolutely. I can imagine that the influences will be so different depending on geographic location.
Well, when the dictionary was first being conceived by British folk, the thought was that it would really help with reading records. And the records in Britain for legal and similar purposes really extend over a wide period and continue quite late. So the thought from British scholars was that this should cover late medieval and Renaissance, as we might think of it, Latin as well, because the records were still being written in Latin, or at least some of them were. This was not very popular with all the other countries. In particular, the Italians were very cross with the idea, because they thought that anything after the death of Dante couldn't possibly be called medieval. They thought it was out of place in a medieval dictionary. That was when the Renaissance started.
Right.
And that just reflects the different interests. If you're interested in Italian literature and art, then it does make sense to say, well, there's a new beginning here in the 14th century. Whereas for our purposes, that would be a totally artificial break. There's no break in British intellectual or institutional life in the 14th century that would have made any sense. So that was why we had this irreconcilable difference that led to the different countries doing their different dictionaries.
And the really British character of the dictionary here.
That's right, yeah. Yes.
How was it in England that medieval Latin stayed relevant for so long? How was it preserved? Did people still speak it all the way through that 1,000 years?
People did speak it, but very few people.
Okay.
It was the spoken language of academia. So if you were a university type, you would speak in Latin when you were doing your philosophy or your science or whatever. That meant that you could be in Prague or Paris or Oxford and it wouldn't really matter.
An international language.
That was the international language of the intellectual world. But locally also, Latin was used for records, for documentary records of accounts for manors, where they needed to know what had been bought in the year, what had been sold, how many sheep had died, what had they died of, that sort of thing. And we actually in Britain have an amazing tradition of these kinds of records, more extensive, I believe, than in other countries. Legal records of court cases, people being hit over the head with various implements, which is often our only source for these things. There's a word for a kind of stick that you carry a bucket with, if it's a very large bucket and you need two people. Mm-hmm. And this word is mostly found in criminal records for murder cases, because it was somebody went to the brewery and picked up one of these things and killed somebody with it. So,
gosh. That's fascinating. So I heard that one of the myths that the dictionaries that the people working around it are sort of trying to debunk is that medieval Latin was just this religious language or just used in the church, and very little application anywhere else, and that it was somehow some sort of lesser form of classical Latin. But it sounds like there's a huge variety of sources that you've been using.
That's right, yes. There is some church Latin. Mm. There's actually quite a lot of church Latin.
Sure.
And that is very important, but it is only one of many varieties of Latin, one of the reasons that Latin was used. So we have medical texts that have incredible imports from Greek and Arabic, being the major scientific traditions.
Arabic, yes.
Arabic is a major source of new terminology from the 12th century onwards, when a lot of that scientific work, especially, and also philosophical work, mm-hmm. is translated from the Arabic into Latin, often in Spain, Moorish Spain, where you have amazing meeting of cultures. So sometimes these words make it into modern English. So the word zenith, which we're reasonably familiar with as being the point where the sun reaches its highest, yes. Highest point, is an Arabic word that means direction, which is not very illuminating as a definition.
No, that's really cool. So it comes through that.
Yes. And actually, this was when this came into Latin. It was usually given as a two-word phrase. It was the zenith capitis, the direction of the head. And so in English then that of the head qualification dropped out, and we're left with this word because we don't know what zenith means originally. It's fine on its own. So yes, there's a lot of Arabic influence there. Greek as well, from philosophy. A curious thing that I found when I was working on one of my first words for the dictionary, which was saponera. It's a classical Latin word. It means to place underneath. But it acquires new meanings over time, and we're familiar now in modern English with the word suppose. It's a very familiar word.
Yes.
But the strange thing about this is that that's a philosophical use of saponera that only came into Latin in about 1200.
Amazing. So, yeah, a lot of things come out of that transitional medieval period.
Yes. That came through really from Greek, because because Aristotle used the Greek equivalent of saponera to give words like, we still have hypothesis as a word, that's the direct Greek equivalent. So yes, there's a lot of influence on present day English that comes in through this. So it's a two-way process. It's not just that the Latin was a receiver of these strange English words, it's also that they came back into the English language.
It's influenced the language, yeah. A while ago I found out that macabre came from Arabic. I think it means graveyard. And macabre or something, and I was fascinated by that, the fact that so many words that you just use day to day and you don't really know where they come from. That's fascinating. So how and when did you become involved in the project?
I joined just over 3 years ago. I'd just finished my doctorate, which was in medieval philosophy, mm-hmm. And so I'd read an awful lot of medieval Latin, and that's actually one of that illustrates something as well. If you're studying philosophy any point before, say, 1650, certainly, you need to know Latin. I say any point before 1650, any point before 1650 and after about 500 AD or something like that. But it is the language in which all of that stuff is written. Mm. Most of it's still untranslated. I saw the job advertised and thought, that sounds fascinating.
Ideal.
I'd had to use this dictionary myself. I'd found it very useful. I leapt at the chance to join And I think they were very glad to have someone who could read the philosophy.
I can imagine.
A slightly unusual piece of expertise.
Yes, dense treaties and things. So what have you been doing in the dictionary as an assistant editor? What's been your job?
Well, the main thing is drafting the entries. Mm-hmm. So my in tray is a very very fetching shoebox, which is full of pieces of paper, quotation slips, with handwritten entries from people. Now, the way the dictionary was constructed was that the first thing was to get a lot of quotations from sources that people had found interesting uses of words or interesting looking words or things that just didn't make any sense. And they'd written these things out on small pieces of paper, sort of 6x4 bits of paper. And that process started in the 1920s. And we use that as our input. So it's been alphabetized according to, you know, by the most interesting word in it. But sometimes it's clear what the words mean, and sometimes it isn't. And the job really consists of, firstly, taking a tranche of these slips and trying to see which ones go together to be in the same word and which ones have to be... where the separation lies between words, that's not always obvious. And then to find out what the word means in each of these cases and to try to come up with a dictionary entry that's based on those and that lays out the senses in a way that is intelligible to the reader and doesn't lead them down blind alleys and that sort of thing. It's quite difficult to know, and there isn't a unique right answer, but it's quite difficult to know how to organise an entry like that. So you might have a word like trahara, which has basically a meaning of to pull or to drag, but then that's used in various different kinds of contexts. Now, a very basic dictionary, a sort of Collins Gem type dictionary, would give, say, 3 or 4 words in translation saying to pull, drag, that sort of thing. But we want to be a bit more helpful than that, and knowing quite how finely to distinguish things is a very... it's an art rather than a science, and we all have different opinions on how that should be done. But some of the work then is a bit more challenging than that. Sometimes it's, this word doesn't appear to make any sense at all.
Right.
I don't even recognise what kind of word it is supposed to be, and so a process starts of trying to sleuth this, hunt this word down. Sometimes it is a matter of it coming from something like Arabic, where you wouldn't... Well, I wouldn't expect to recognise it because I don't know Arabic, and the people who were writing these words at the time often didn't know Arabic either, in fact, usually didn't, so they've been heavily corrupted. Those are, I think, some of our most difficult challenges and ones that we often don't meet. We have a fair few question marks in the dictionary where we've just had to admit we don't know what this word is.
I remember being surprised when I was when I did classics as an undergraduate and translating something that that I later found out was fairly obscure and coming across and looking up things in a dictionary and eventually finding it and seeing the bit of passage that I was trying to translate there with Hapax Legomenon only, it's only in this place in the whole corpus of literature and you don't sort of realise that it can be like that people can have so little idea. We've got this one word in this one place, and it's all about interpretation of what
yes,
it means.
It's particularly surprising for medieval Latin, because classical Latin has a very limited corpus, as you
yes.
know. You can fit it all on, you know, however many megabytes, but the medieval Latin, the body of stuff that survives is enormous. Most of it hasn't been read for centuries. Most of it is not in print, not accessible. Most of it was not consulted for the dictionary. So we've got a very... we've got a large evidence base. We have something like 1 million quotation slips, but we couldn't look through everything.
This was a
massive crowdsourced effort, and people were given the most important things to read, and then they were told, if you come across anything else that you find interesting, then do, by all means, read it. But... There must be any number of words that we've just missed. So.
Sure. Was there quite a lot then of sort of travelling to libraries or talking to people across distances, trying to find things that are probably not digitised, I imagine, that are just in books?
It's not entirely clear how the process of getting these texts read worked. I think a lot of it was just people would volunteer. They would say, I have a copy of this lying around, here are the details, would you like me to read it for you? And we would say, yes, of course, please do. And then, as I say, in a few cases, there were things we knew that needed to be read. So we had to read Bede, for instance, that was on the hit list. But there were other authors that were not so famous that people might have just come across. I think we do pretty well for the early period because, again, there's not much written in Britain, or at least there's not an unmanageable amount of stuff written, say, before the year 1000. But after about 1100, there's an explosion of material, and all these court cases I mentioned, I don't know how many of those have been looked at as a percentage of the total, but it must be a very small fraction. So we figure that words will probably crop up in the places we've looked for them, but that's not always the case. And these days, of course, it's easier because we have got Google and have got various databases. So if we only have one occurrence of a word, we can try and find more, sometimes with success, and that's it. That's nice. But that's only been in the past few years, and the dictionary has been going for a while.
I must say that when I was preparing for this interview, it sprang into my mind that it was very like, do you watch Blackadder at all?
I have.
Yes, the episode I'm thinking of then.
I do know the episode.
Yes. I'm thinking of the one that's set in the Regency period, and it's about Dr. Johnson and his dictionary. And Dr. Johnson comes trying to seek Prince George's patronage, Prince George, played by Hugh Laurie, and who doesn't really have any idea about the dictionary. And Blackadder, of course, thinks that Dr. Johnson is just a waste of space, and so tries to find words that he's missed out of his dictionary. Do you know one of them?
I think contrafibulation does bring
that
a bell.
That was it, yes.
Possibly discombobulation? I'm not sure if that is
yes.
yes. Yes, actually, well, we had working on our team until I turned up somebody who was fond of making up words in that vein, so that we would find them in our in trays as just a little in joke. We don't think any of these have made their way into print, but we're not entirely sure.
One never knows. Yes, well, luckily I don't know enough medieval Latin to be able to do that to you. So the dictionary is now in proofreading, sort of final editing stage, and it's about to go to print, is that right?
That's right, yes. We reached the end of Z a few weeks ago in draft form. Actually, I was very lucky. I got to do Z myself, and because it's...
So it actually goes from A to Z?
Goes from A to Z, and the last word in it is zithum, which is the last word in quite a few dictionaries.
I can imagine.
It's in Chambers, the Oxford English Dictionary, and the Classical Latin Dictionary, the Oxford Latin Dictionary. It's a Greek word originally, and it's an Egyptian kind of beer.
Cool.
So it's a rather nice note to end on.
Yes.
But yes, Z was quite a small letter, as letters go. It had some funny words in it. Ginger is in there.
Ginger?
Not very obviously, but it begins with Z. At least it's sometimes...
Silent Z.
Well, it sometimes begins with Z, that's the thing. It's one of the kinds of words that, because it wasn't in classical Latin, people weren't sure how to spell it. And so there's a bewildering array. Sometimes it was begun with a G, as we've come to know of it.
Yes.
Sometimes it was begun with J, sometimes Z. And then the middle bit would also get various different interpretations. So you'd get a G or a Z or a J, or sometimes more outlandish spellings that people would just think, I have to write this down because I need to record that somebody bought two bags of ginger or something like that, but
yes.
I don't really know how to spell it. So
no idea what consonant to start this with.
Absolutely. There's no standardisation of spelling from dictionaries or anything like that, so people just... It's a practical language, really.
Yeah.
One assumes that people at the time would have understood what they were reading.
Absolutely. I love how you can get stuff about how people talked as well when you read non-standardised spellings, so that you can sort of see from people's spelling mistakes what it might have sounded like.
That's right, yes. That's one of the major keys to pronunciation, seeing how things were written. Sometimes you get this kind of variation between words that are spelt with a C at the beginning and sometimes they're spelt with an S. And you can see from that it must have been a soft C, because they're not going to get that wrong.
Of course.
They might, if it's a hard C, they might decide to spell it with a K or something at the beginning, but they're not going to put S there.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So yeah, so we've got to the end of the alphabet. So we've got through that massive number of slips that we were starting with back in 1967 when the dictionary was sort of started properly. Now we just have to check a few things. I spent the entire day yesterday in the National Archives in London, and I'll be doing the same thing again tomorrow, as will my colleagues. The manuscript holdings there are vast. They include all the, many of the legal documents and the royal documents, state documents. So we go there to check things that we've quoted from manuscript and that we are a bit unsure of. Because this is that somebody will have read this at some point and scribbled it on a slip and sent it to us. And people are not always flawless in their copying out of such things. So we need to go and check them. And that's a very fun day out. It's not fun getting from Oxford to London in a car. But
no.
It is fun being there and handling these documents, which anyone in the UK, as far as I know, is entitled to do by birthright, as it were. You can be reading something that's from 1200 and is a record of what the Queen had bought for her in her wardrobe.
That's
things
amazing.
Like that. It's and these are very hard wearing documents. The vellum that they're written on is not indestructible, but the more important the document, generally speaking, the nicer the stuff it's written on, and it's wonderful to see these. These ancient documents.
That's amazing to actually be able to read them and get such an insight into people's lives from so long ago. That is amazing. So there are some events going on in Oxford this year, aren't there, to celebrate the publication of the dictionary.
We have a conference lined up in mid-December, which is a celebration of our getting there, which is a major thing. A lot of dictionaries of this kind just die at some point.
I can imagine. Such a lot of work.
Yes, and well, we almost died at M in about 2000. We had funding problems. It's not always been easy. We've generally been funded by the British Academy, who started the project off, but their funding has been cut repeatedly, and so we had to find money from elsewhere. Happily, somebody did step in. We were able to get to the end. So it's a very exciting moment. So there'll be a conference in Oxford that is about medieval Latin in Britain, or Latin in medieval Britain, as I think it's called.
But sure.
It'll be an academic conference that's aiming at trying to understand more about how Latin was used and what it was used for, largely based tied to what we've done with the dictionary. And at the same time, there's also going to be an exhibition in the Bodleian that will last a little longer. It's just a small exhibition by the entrance.
I know the one. It's when you go into the quad and on the left, there's the little exhibition room where the exhibition changes every few months. Is it that one?
It's smaller still than that,
smaller
actually.
Than that.
It's when you go into the... If you're going into the main entrance of the Bodleian, on the right-hand side, there's a glass display case. And we'll have some manuscripts out there and some printed books, perhaps bits of the dictionary to just show something about the project.
So you can see where some of the words came from and where they ended up in the dictionary.
That's right.
Brilliant. That exhibition is on... it starts on Wednesday the 11th of December and it runs until January the 6th. So it's a good Christmas pastime to go there and see where these words came from. And to accompany that, there's also a talk. Is that right? By Dr. David Howlett?
That's right, yes. David is really one of the major figures in the dictionary's history. He was its editor from 1979 to 2011.
Wow.
So that's an incredible span. He wasn't the editor to start with. For a few years, Ronald Latham was the editor, and he's not there at the end. Richard Ashdown took over a couple of years ago, but really this is, in some sense, David's dictionary, so he'll be giving a talk about how this is, how the dictionary has been made from his perspective, which will be on the 12th of December at the Bodleian, and there's actually a very limited number of places for that. You have to book through the Bodleian.
Right, and it's free, is that right? So
it is free, yes.
So you can say booking advised. That's on the 12th of December, 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. at the Bodleian, and you can go and hear all about it again from from Dr. David Howlett. And where is the dictionary available?
Well, at the moment it's available in part in many academic libraries in the UK and abroad. It's been published in instalments called fascicles, little bundles, since 1975. The first one came out in 1975, it was A to B, and these things now are in print up to the end of S, pretty much. When it's fully finished, we're not sure if it will be available in a sort of off-the-shelf form. I don't know whether you'll be able to go into Waterstones or wherever and take this thing off the shelves, but you can get it online. It's actually prohibitively expensive, I should say, for individuals. It's intended really to be bought by institutions. It will be available online.
That's really good.
Hopefully for free.
Amazing.
We have a very generous set of funding from the Packard Foundation. That's the Packard of Hewlett Packard. His son was a classicist, and he's very keen on promoting digital humanities, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So hopefully this will be online within a year.
Brilliant.
For free, which should make it the first port of call, really, for anyone who's wanting to translate Latin of any kind, even classical Latin, because the Oxford Latin Dictionary, which is our sort of mother project, if you like, it's really the same sort of thing done very well for classical Latin, is not available online.
I see. So, yeah, so this is the one that's going to be available for all the people.
That's right, all the people. And you've been a classics student yourself. Mm. You'll know that people tend to use Lewis and Short online,
yes.
Which is a very bad dictionary, I should say. It's a 19th century sort of revision or mishmash from a German dictionary, and it's not very well done. So one of the things that we're very excited about is the possibility that people will use this dictionary an awful lot. Once it is online, for all kinds of purposes.
Mm.
People might be digging up their family history or trying to find out about their local town or something like that, and really there's a lot of information in there that they should have access to.
Brilliant. Are there any other snippets about the dictionary that you can tell us that are exciting to know?
Well, yes, there was something that I thought people might be interested in. You'll know the English phrase hanged, drawn and quartered.
Yes.
Do you know what drawn means?
I thought that it was the horrible thing where you sort of slice out someone's insides, but maybe that's the quartering.
I'm very glad you say that, because actually that is what people tend to think.
Yeah.
It's what the Oxford English Dictionary says under draw. It's actually not right, and this is something that is clear from the Middle English Dictionary, which covers this word, but it's also clear now from our dictionary, at least it will be when we're published, because the medieval Latin equivalent for this word was trahere, which is in classical Latin mean to draw or drag, and we looked very carefully at the sources for this, because we'd got this idea in our heads as well, that this is going to be like that horrible bit in Braveheart, where Mel Gibson is sliced apart.
I know the bit.
with that hook. And actually, in all the cases where any kind of detail was given about this drawing that happened, this trahere activity, it involved being behind a horse. And it was pretty clear that it was a matter of being dragged. So, for instance, you had one chap who was on his way to be executed and was being dragged behind a horse, and a very kindly bishop. Well, not that kindly, actually. This is the bishop who'd sentenced him to execution. But anyway, a now merciful bishop held his head so that it wouldn't bang along the cobbles as he was dragged along. So it's a very different kind of punishment. It's also very unpleasant. People were sometimes allowed to be on some kind of platform so that it wasn't that unpleasant. But it's still, you're being punished in a pretty serious way, but it's nothing to do with evisceration. It turns out this is based on a misunderstanding from the 19th century.
Okay.
So we haven't actually hanged, drawn and quartered anyone in Britain for a very long time, since roughly the 18th century. And so people weren't really quite sure what was involved, and they, I guess, checked their dictionaries and found that to draw a fowl, a bird, is to, among other things, I think, to pull its entrails out.
I see.
And so they thought, they did that?
That must
in
be
the
what
Middle
it is.
Ages? And of course this does fit in nicely with our sort of thoughts about medieval brutality and that sort of thing.
Mm.
So there's no evidence for it in British medieval Latin, certainly, so that's something that we've cleared up in just a very small way. We don't make any sort of fanfare about it. Obviously, I'm doing that now, but it'll just be there by its absence in the dictionary, you won't find it defined as to eviscerate. But we had quotation slips coming in from readers who did think it meant eviscerate. And so we've got these nice things where somebody has been hanged, drawn and quartered. And obviously quartering is not very nice either, I should say.
No.
But at least I think you're dead by that point. But where the reader submitting the quotation slip has written as their definition for it, eviscerate.
Wow, because it's entered the public imagination
that's
so
right,
much.
Yes, yes.
So the reality is much more classical in a way, isn't it? The whole dragging behind a chariot thing.
Absolutely, yes. This is where it comes from as a punishment. It's a classical punishment for traitors. I think the thought is you're being exposed to public view.
Mm.
Not only are you being punished, but everyone can see you're going through the city.
It's a humiliation
and it hurts.
Yes. Wow. That's fascinating and nicely gruesome. And apart from you, who else is on the team?
Well, there are 5 people in my position, mm-hmm. assistant editors, and we have an editor above us. We also have a consulting editor. This is actually a very legendary figure, really, in Latin lexicography. He was the editor of the Oxford Latin Dictionary from 1954 until it was finished in 1982. He recently celebrated his 89th birthday.
It's
Peter Glare. He's a wonderful man. He comes in a few times a week and checks everything that we do, and he's very incisive. He often can see that we've got things very wrong in some way or another, so it's good that we have that as a controlling influence. We also have an XML developer who is responsible for making sure our database is properly functional, and we'll be setting things up so that we can have an online edition of the dictionary.
So that's fascinating. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. That was brilliant, and we will look out for those events in December, the exhibition at the Bodleian running over Christmas, and the talk to accompany it, and look out for the dictionary being in libraries and online, hopefully in the near future. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.